All philanthropy exists to make up for the shortfalls in the design of social systems, including business, which lead to inequity, inequality, indifference, and inattention, which leaves do-gooders working on the symptoms after the fact of these radically inadequately designed systems.
Welcome back to Business Sick and Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. But first, we want to thank our sponsor, Business Sick and Opinion, Guayaki. I have not been disappointed picking up new flavors of Guayaki recently. Have you guys all tried Orange Exuberance? It's just awesome. We're also glad that Guayaki continues to brew their mate-based goodness through this challenging time. Mate, it also turns out, contains 24 vitamins and minerals, 15 amino acids, and abundant polyphenols. So it gives me the energy I want while also being a healthy choice. We hope you're going to check out this great beverage with your friends and family, and please let us know what you think. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion. As you know by now, a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn more about how to work more closely with us, stay tuned at the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout. And with me, as always, is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big, hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Zach.
Okay, Carol, we got a request on our Twitter for this week. And it's, by the way, if anyone wants to ask us a question on Twitter, it's biz_second_opinion. And this one was all about philanthropy.
Right. The tweet actually pointed to an article about philanthropy that's published in an online blog called The Daily Good, which I read often. The submission suggested that it aligned with our regenerative philosophy and approach. And didn't they think this fit and I wasn't going to be able to find anything to counter in it? So now you've read it too. Can you see what they were seeing, what was likely in this reader's mind that made them think that the blog authors must work with us, which is part of what they said. They actually thought that.
Yeah. So before we move forward, listeners, you can check out the article on dailygood.org by searching the story entitled "Is Philanthropy Really Changing Anything?" by Vijay Shah. You know, I'll say, Carol, that the folks at Daily Good do attempt to make us all more conscious in our daily living through their articles. But not unlike all of us as humans in modern times, they are missing some very core things here. So let me just kind of give a little bit of background here. So the article speaks to problems of philanthropy by first offering it as a solution to everything that's wrong with capitalism, from the pursuit of profit to lack of government intervention and wealth inequality. In the end, the article proposes that philanthropy could be a solution to all these problems, but inexorably seems plagued by many of its kind of own similar issues. So the article suggests that philanthropy could take a three-pronged approach instead. So first, cultivate humility in program deliverables by removing an approach that measures, quote unquote, lives transformed by that philanthropic approach. In other words, this approach puts philanthropists in the place of needing to rescue poor people who are helpless victims, and they want to stop doing that by stopping the measurement of it. Second, go beyond a one-way assessment of program delivery where feedback is no longer just about program evaluation. Instead, it goes beyond to actually being a two-way feedback process that listens to customers' experiences, preferences, and ideas to help improve the quality of the programs. And third, observe systems thinking towards systems change. With this idea, the author actually proposes we're all connected, and so we need interconnected solutions. And then the author goes on to describe their portfolios, actually, and how they approach systems thinking by looking beyond single point statistics and data, by looking instead at what ultimately influences that data. Okay, I think I got it all.
Wow. Yep. Now, what did they miss? Even with their good intentions, which this group that was writing this article and publishing it actually have?
Well, I'm sure we're going to get to this part, but the author never really considered the core premise of philanthropy to begin with. Is that where we're actually headed today?
Well, for me, it is. It's challenging, I think, in today's times, and a lot of these people are my friends, to be good-hearted people. You're seeking to have a kind of what we might call a purpose-based life. But unfortunately, we're about a century behind in being able to see how humans work and how we're nested in some greater living system. The authors of this are trapped in a behaviorist theory. And I'm always brokenhearted when I see that. That's like, humans still need some external impetus, some kind of incentives, directive, all, of course, done benevolently in this case, if you're going to bring about change in the outcome. I've written about this so many times, I sometimes get tired. I did an article in The Economist a few years ago on why CSR is an unethical practice. And my argument, I think, is still connected to what we're doing here with philanthropy. I believe that philanthropy is immoral. And that may seem a bit harsh, but think about this. All philanthropy exists to make up for the shortfalls in the design of social systems, including business, which lead to inequity, inequality, indifference, and inattention, which leaves do-gooders working on the symptoms after the fact of these radically inadequately designed systems. So let's maybe give some examples and cases where this is true. Well, first, do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, for sure. I mean, you know, when I, once again, I use healthcare quite often as an example, but when I worked there, I saw it all the time, right? Like philanthropists and donors would need to be called on to help fund some giant new project of some kind, some build out or what have you. And there'd be a tremendous amount of cajoling and hobnobbing to try to get local foundations to extract as much money out of the wealthiest citizens as it possibly could for this build. And there was rarely a conversation, though, about why the shortfall in funding needed to be filled by foundations in the first place. And like, what's actually driving such an incomplete approach?
Yeah. And many of the people who they were talking to about funding had been fighting the design of systems, which would have made this a very different situation. So I think we can say the first problem we have here is we're on the wrong end of the stick. Like, philanthropy is after everything has been caved in, created, made a mess of. And we're trying to fix something with philanthropy after the fact that is now flawed from the beginning in the way it was designed, which to me leads to the next concern, which makes philanthropy immoral. And by its nature, and I should say others are involved in this, not just philanthropists, but the very nature of foundations and philanthropists individually is they fragment. They find symptoms. They find issues and problems, and they call it problem definition. And they may put a cluster of those together to work on it. But now you've got maybe 100 groups in one town working with a piece of the puzzle, which they do speak to in this article, but their solution is pretty limited. They each have a different theory of change, a different approach and method about how they're working on it. And even if they're working on the same subject, they're not on the same page with the same arena and the same people they're working with.
Yeah, it seems to violate a few of the first principles of living systems that we've talked about before. I mean, I could say that one example of fragmenting while trying to do good is the entire world of disease-focused philanthropy, right? Like, look at cancer, heart disease, diabetes, you name it. All of these are focused on abstract diseases, all with the same mandate of raising awareness and research on a cure. So I'm getting pretty old. I'm like 40, about to be 41. And I don't think any of the $90 billion on research that the National Cancer Institute has raised in my lifetime or the 260 cancer nonprofits in the U.S. seem to have made much of a dent in anything. So they soldier on working at cross purposes with other organizations, designing redundant programs and just generally spinning their wheels.
Yeah. Every time I hear somebody advertise race for the cure or search for the cure, I said, I want to say, what about the cause? How do we get here? Right. Race for the cause. Oh, well. So the shortfall you just described, of course, starts with this fragmented community in mind and people who are dissected. Like, even if you got cancer, it's like a part of your body has cancer, not the person. So you people end up with a fragmented sense of the self, and the philanthropist or the foundation creating philanthropy makes it even worse by taking on parts and pieces with all these differing views. And of course, this is compounded by philanthropists are working from this 4-century-old paradigm I referenced, and an old theory of change, which came from Newton. And you've all heard me describe that, but I'm going to do it again so we can see it right now that philanthropists do. They have a billiard ball model of change where they are the cue stick and they determine who and what needs to move toward what particular pocket they need to put it in. And all this really does is continue to fragment and perpetuate and accelerate all the challenges that we have. And I'm sorry to keep saying this billiard model, but it's so clear to me. And so I'm hoping people can learn to hold that in mind when they go after some of these things.
Yeah. And back to your point, I mean, it's like with this cancer research that we've talking about here, it distills everyone down to a cancer survivor or not. And rather than just considering the entirety of that person, the scope of their life, the community, the planet, and how they're seeking to contribute.
Right. And as I said, they usually even get it down to the level of where it is in the body. Well, anyway, where does that leave us? And there are a whole bunch of false assumptions that our blog writer is making.
Yeah. So I think I'll take a crack at this. Ultimately, I think it leaves philanthropists still in the driver's seat of other people's lives, as you're saying, this kind of cue stick phenomenon. It assumes that this behavioral assumption of the need for external intervention. Like, look at number two again, right? They're using a feedback-driven process to raise the bar in their programs. It still puts the agency of the entire situation on the philanthropist and the foundation and takes it away from the people they're attempting to help. It still sees these folks as fundamentally in need of a change that only the philanthropist can deliver. And the author obviously attempts to soften the blow of this by talking to the people first, but it's still about rescuing people beyond that are seen as beyond their own capability to help themselves.
Yeah. And of course, that's so much part of the humanist movement idea. And the humanist movement, with all of its good intention to get rid of the behaviorists treating us like rats, brought in so many things. And one of them was that we could be intuitive, we could see other people, we could understand them. And what really happens, and it's here in their description, we can't see it. It's clear they don't see yet that even what they're talking about doing with leaving the philanthropists trying to do better what they do is they're still all the time projecting the philanthropist idea about where the pocket is on the cue table and what it is that people need to go toward. So we have this crazy thing about us thinking other people are all like us, but we also think even when philanthropy is in natural systems, we start to think of animals and we call them watersheds and airsheds, like we anthropomorphize them as they belong to us. And then we project all the characteristics onto those natural and non-human systems. So it's a core toxic practice of humanity, which they took off the same page of humanist thinking, which is we know what's good for other people.
Another humanist practice they pick up on is that in philanthropy, it's this idea that, quote unquote, paternalism rules. So this author that they cite, Anand Giridharadas, he wrote this book called Winners Take All, and they cite it in the article, and he talks about this quite extensively. And this is where the power is in the hands of the rich, or worse, it becomes colonizing, especially in the minds and the decisions of those who are actually enacting it. This is definitely an insidious idea, and after a few generations, even after resisting for generations, it comes to dominate how everyone comes to think. Unfortunately, they miss the point that this entire approach is colonizing by approaching these unfortunate souls in desperate need of change.
Right, right. And you know what they miss in their suggestion, and I think we ought to talk about those, is any idea about the quantum view of the world. So they say, you know, be humble. Well, be humble by not taking credit. And do a little more than numbers. Get their input and feedback and go and get systems view. But all of those, actually, when they described them, were all still a billiard ball model of the philanthropist does it for them, but seeks their participation. What we want them to look at is what it means to move this quantum view, which is really hard to get, I know. It's working at the level of the implicate order. And it's not like cause, although I joked about that earlier. It's more like, what is the lack of capability or the lack of culture that we can't pick up with our senses? We have to be able to see it at work. We have to be able to see how the world is shaping, being shaped beyond what our senses can do. And we have to work at it indirectly. Like, think, for example, we know that when we have a bad attitude about something, don't try and talk to us. That's going to shape what the conversation between me and my business or life partner are going to work on. Or when we have a culture in an organization, you can't go in and tinker with things and change a few of the behavioral guidelines or even mindset. If you have the mindset that people are stupid and they're born that way and it'll stay that way, nothing much is going to change. You have to shift to working on what is the indirect that's bringing that into play, like the attitude, the culture, the mindset, the capability. And you have to, at the same time, work less or maybe even very little on direct approaches like do this for them. Like, I nearly died when I saw in this article that the person who sent it on Twitter didn't even pick up on switch from being the doers to being the nudgers and triggers. That's just a humanistic, nicer form of behavioralism. We'll trigger them. We'll nudge them. Yeah, try doing that with your teenager and see what you get. So the billiard ball is still, in their entire setup, being a cue stick for philanthropists toward the pocket that's determined by the philanthropist.
So I think, Carol, I think working indirectly is hard for most people to get. I think that's because they want to help, so they feel compelled to do something, even if it escalates the situation, because they want results and they want to see them now, right? There's a sense of urgency, even if that leads to conflict and ultimately the effects create externalities and eventual backsliding. Even worse, they think it's about everyone else and not themselves, right? Like, I'm always kind of surprised and a bit heartbroken to hear a philanthropist who owns a series of fast food chains say, but I give to the United Way diabetes research arm every year, for example.
Right. And of course, that's kind of an oblique indirect thing, but that's not what we're talking about here. It's like, do harm and then absolve yourself. But it's not at the level of cause that they're looking at. And so we have to learn to proceed not in time and space. So you may have noticed sometimes when you try and get your son or daughter to do something immediately at the moment when you think, well, this is a great teaching moment, we should point this out so people can learn to see it. But it actually doesn't work that way because the implicate order is not appropriate at the time. So let's take some examples maybe of indirect as they come from our lives where we know it exists, even if we don't always know what to do about it.
Okay, so full disclosure, I am no parent of the year by any means. But if I look at how my wife has approached the situation with our daughter in recent memory, so I saw for years how my daughter struggled to find a thing that she wanted to do, whether it was like a sport or a hobby or something. And I would get frustrated and look at what she's wasn't doing and point to solutions and things she could try and do and to try this and do this and what's wrong with you. But instead, my wife released that idea and tried to approach her by creating a ritual where she and our daughter would go for walks together. And my wife would take the time to ask her questions and have her reflect on who she's becoming and what's moving in her life. And so when my daughter decided to try out for soccer and look for a part-time job, it came from her and has been on her terms. And now she loves soccer and her job. And it's not about soccer or the job, but her ability to build will towards creating aspects of her life where she actually finds meaning. And the funny part here is I obviously never, in all the million things I suggested soccer or find a job.
Right.
And all the stuff I was pushing on her.
That's such a beautiful example of refusing to be acoustic and refusing to treat her as a ball that you have to move and to predetermine the pocket. Who knows what the right one is? In fact, that metaphor doesn't even fit in the world. And I'd love to hear our listeners, if they've got ideas about what they think the metaphor is of quantum, of what Alexa did when she went for a walk. And the ritual that you spoke to is so important. And the questions, rather than giving answers or suggestions, and the patience and the space it takes. So what I did with my kids, I wrote extensively about this in my most recent book, The Regenerative Life, where I invited each child, and I had a few of them to go through, at the age of 6 to pick something in their world that they wanted to have the family become involved in, and they would invite us, but they were in charge. Like, my daughter picked cleaning her room. When they were 9 years old, I had them pick a family system, which they wanted to steward for the whole family. And my son picked feeding us, and my daughter picked paying the bills. I mean, these were 9-year-old things. Now, you'd say, how in the world could you do that? Well, we sat down weekly in a family meeting. They projected what they wanted to be able to do. We talked about what capability they needed, what they wanted to learn, how they wanted to learn it, what role they wanted me to play. They were in charge of everything. And every Sunday night when we had our family meeting, the question was not me, or the attempt was not me telling them how they did, but them assessing, me assessing how well I did on the role I agreed I would play, and what we were each going to do the following week, and what new capability we needed. That's indirect, and it's indirect in that I didn't pick the pocket, I didn't describe what the cue ball ought to be like, and I refused to be acoustic. So the same thing can happen in education. If you just look at what I said, schools, which are based on evaluating processes where kids become involved, rather than having knowledge and stuff they memorize, we can build education systems on self-directed choices, designing our own learning, committing to the effects we want to have for a family, for a greater whole, and having time to reflect on a ritual basis. All of that is at the implicate level.
Yeah, so if I look at my own education, for example, I can see the effects of direct and indirect when I was actually most engaged. So it was always those projects where I was using my hands to design something fun. It was like the learning came in the process of the design, whether that was like a Rube Goldberg kind of machine to teach physics or a board game to teach history. Although I loved it, I did always feel a little bit duped when it turns out I was still trying to be taught something useful.
Yeah. Well, I think one other thing might help people see what we mean by implicate here. We talk a lot about systemic effects. That's actually an implicate idea. And for the most part, people know how to work on it. That's why we do that in our communities, teaching people how to go from self-actualizing to system actualizing. Plus, you have to put in place infrastructure like ritual walks, like me, ritual evening meetings, frameworks, which people are all shared thinking through. And that gives everyone a way to hold and be guided by what it is that's going on. Even, you know, if you look in business, it's like the hiring and the legal systems. They have built into them racism, classism, and they perpetuate all the shortfalls that, again, we were talking about philanthropy. In family parenting, also, we could both see that example. So we have to give up, as I hinted at earlier, this idea of a teaching moment, because the teaching moment is the parent having picked the pocket and described what they thought was wrong with the cue ball, the child. Instead of having something out of space and time in a ritual infrastructure kind of way, based on the goals or the youth in Sophie's case have set, and then do reflection, where the emotional center, which is an implicate process, is quieted. And then that person, that child, that youth can be self-directed.
And the idea of, you know, thinking outside of space and time is really hard to do, because I feel like I always say that I have no time for that kind of thinking. Really, I'm just not creating it for myself intentionally.
Yeah, you're not setting up the infrastructure and the ritual. So let's go back and look at, because I think we'll speak a little more to their suggestions. Let's get a little summary here. You put one together earlier. Can you remind us of their suggestions?
Totally, yeah. So going back to kind of their set of solutions here that they offer in the article. So first off, cultivate humility. Basically, they're saying we need to stop counting so much and taking credit as philanthropists for the counting of lives transformed. Essentially, unfortunately, this essentially gives up the credit for any change, but accepts more of a nudger role, still leaving the folks who are trying to help as victims.
Right.
Second, go beyond one-way assessment program evaluation. Instead, move into more of a two-way feedback conversation to understand people's lives. And then third, observe systems thinking towards systems change. Instead, evaluate philanthropy programs looking at the deeper causes of the surface metrics.
Right. And they don't mean implicate like we do, as we'll speak to here. We do have to give up the idea that we know what's best for others, which is a lot more than just being humble about taking credit and counting something different. But they are still missing the billiard ball nature of everything that they organize. And the worst one, that, as I've said twice, and I'm going to say it one more time, is this whole idea of nudges and triggers is just toxic to a system being self-directed. It's like a benevolent behaviorism. And they're suggesting there's more work like coaching people along, I think, when they're talking about nudges. But we want people to be a resource in the way Alexa was. And she designed a system. She designed a ritual. And she left it to Sophie based on some questions. Questions are a very different way to be with people.
And none of this speaks to the symptoms and the fragmented nature that philanthropy is kind of pursued by the benefactor. But Carol, what would the argument be here about assessment? We talk about, you know, your book, No More Feedback, but what about in this context?
Yeah, well, they suggest a very old idea, which I keep thinking we've gotten rid of, which is a participative model. So people get to participate. It's a two-way conversation. I, as the authority, get to decide what we're going to do, but I ask for your opinion, AG feedback. And you get to comment on what I'm doing. All of that came out of the humanist and human potential era. And it pervades business and, of course, philanthropy. So the basis of what they suggest doesn't go far enough. We need to ask, what is going on at a level that precedes it? The question that I think should be asked there is, what kind of capability needs to be built in the organization so they can design it themselves? We did a whole project with DuPont some years ago and asked a group of homeless, mostly men, although there were a few families involved, what they wanted. And they said they wanted to learn to build their own building. They wanted to run to govern their own organization. They wanted to be able to raise their own money to do it. They became completely in charge. There was no participation in DuPont Foundation's work. And then they got to give input. Nope, they took it on and were fully looking at it. Here, what they suggested was, well, let's improve the quality and effectiveness of the social programs we as philanthropists design. It's not even all the way out to the lives, and they think they've gotten somewhere. But what they need to look at is, why aren't they building capability with everything that happens? That's an implicate order, because it's there tomorrow and the next day and the day after and for years to come. In fact, there was a wonderful piece of research just published that showed if you actually gave homeless people money, several thousand dollars, and taught them a bit about how the housing system worked, the majority of them were able long-term, after 4 or 5 months when they checked this, find a place to live, find a place to have food, bring their family in, and no one told them how to spend the money or build something. That's such a radically different idea than participation, their second suggestion.
Totally. And so for third, now we're back to systems thinking, or their idea of systems thinking. And the author gives an example of how they look at their portfolio evaluation process in the context of trying to measure second order causes. So again, This feels like the pool cue striking the ball again. Am I right?
Yeah. In addition to that, you mentioned the seven first principles earlier, which are a way to get a hold of this implicate order. And you can tell when people are in the, I would call, middle field. They're trying to not be billiard ball people. You can feel this author not wanting to be a billiard ball and noticing their systems. And you can tell it when they haven't gone all the way to a regenerative living systems view, because they'll talk about connecting the parts. Interconnectedness means that there were parts that you had to connect. There's no living system. You can't take any frog you ever cut up and glue it back together and ever have it come to life. So they're working from the wrong paradigm when they even talk about systems thinking. They're using machine version. They also are suggesting that they work with not just enrollment numbers, which I'm so glad they're not going to do that in one of the schools in India, but back up and say, how well are they learning? Well, to me, that is like a causal thing, but it's not implicate. What they're doing is trying to look for some precursor, but they haven't asked what it is that they're targeting. Why are they targeting learning levels? Why are they even targeting enrollment numbers? What they want are, what are the people who are in the system measuring? What are each of them counting as their lives being transformed? How do they have the people measure and speak back to it? So you need to change not only from this billiard ball model to get to the whole system, but you have to let go of this humanist model that's on the way to there, where you really are looking at what are being measured, not just by your standards, but by people who are self-directed and checking their own standards.
So I think they need to examine their own theory of change then. They're right about the worries with the philanthropy model and how it works currently, but they don't go to a quantum view, which gives an even clearer view of reality and how humans work in a system. But wait, okay. So Carol, we titled this podcast The Immorality of Philanthropy. Did we really make that case here though?
Well, the way I make the case is that everything that philanthropy takes on, I don't get many examples which are outside of it, come from problems that were created and shortfalls because of the way we've designed systems for humans and natural systems to live in. So it's a cleanup act. It's coming in behind, and it works on letting people feel good about themselves, like your fast food owner you were talking about. That whole process pervades the suggestions that are here too. And in a couple of cases, they're not just in the billiard ball. They're trying to get beyond that. They're trying to do more that is kind of a humanistic view. But I want them, and before it cannot be immoral, they have to have the people whose lives that are they're working with be involved in the co-creation, not the participation, feedback, et cetera, and not interconnecting all the existing fragmented things and calling it systems thinking, and not being humble, which, you know, I can just see someone sitting in the corner and say, well, I'm just not going to take credit for that. There's nothing here that goes back and deals with the implicate set. And there's nothing that really puts, which if you were going to do that, you'd have to work on the other thing they don't take care of, which is people being fully self-directed in their lives. So stay tuned on how you can join us in learning a lot more about what we've been talking about, the quantum idea, this indirect theory of change, and particularly for governing bodies, for not-for-profits, for-profits, all kinds of boards. We're going to invite you to something so you could, as a leader in any kind of organization, especially a governing body, be able to work more effectively, faster, and deeper without the toxic side effects.
Yeah, so to Carol's point, we have a virtual 2020 summit coming up November 17th, where we do have a few seats left. And the focus is on the regenerative governing board, working from a far more effective paradigm. So bring some or all of your board of directors or advisory board or any one of the role of governors or similar bodies. And don't forget, it's you can find it at regenerativebusinesssummit.com, and it's November 17th.
That summit we do annually, and it's always for teams of people, three or more. But we do have communities for individuals who play different kind of roles, everything from entrepreneurs to educators, change agents, economic shapers, and even some work with parents. If you want to check out as an individual, you can go to seed-communities.com and learn more about that.
We need you, dear listeners. Please don't forget to recommend an article or business practice on which you want a second opinion. And if you do, we're going to send you one of our Business Second Opinion mugs. So you can email us at carol@businesssecondopinion.com or find us on Twitter at @biz_second_opinion. Also, don't forget, you can support us by donating to our production support costs on the Business Second Opinion webpage.
And I want to invite anyone who loves reading, loves talking about anything in any book, but particularly my book, The Regenerative Life. I've created a book club that your organization can join. It includes a workbook, video online workshops, and all of it's for free if you buy books in bulk through my publisher and meet their criteria. Go to carolsanford.com and learn more about book clubs. And you can sign up for my newsletter at carolsanford.com while you're there. I think it's at the bottom of the page where you can get more information. Plus, you can find Business Second Opinion's webpage off of carolsanford.com, where you can get lots more ideas and connections.
And thanks to NumiT and Babson College for sponsoring the Regenerative Business Summit and Prize annually. Also, don't forget to check out the Business Second Opinion website for more info on our podcast. This has been Business Second Opinion.